Okay. And we have Mr. Dance for the appellant and Ms. Hughes, is that right? Thank you. For the appellee. And Mr. Dance, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. About 4 or 5 minutes. I'll keep an eye on the clock.
Okay. I won't interrupt you then.
Thank you, Judge.
And we're happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Dance of Dance & Waldman. I represent Mr. Chung in this appeal matter. Your Honors, the questions to be answered in this case simply is one error of law, whether or not the trial court had the authority to determine and then award spousal support to the wife after the trial court struck the wife's complaint for divorce, which was the only pleading properly before the court that requested an award of spousal support be made in her favor pursuant to Section 20-107.1 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended. Based upon the case law that existed at the time of the trial, the answer to that question is simply no. Now, by way of background, the facts of the case are as follows. Ms. Chung filed for divorce based upon constructive abandonment / desertion. She made no other requests for relief for divorce, other grounds. I'm sorry, she pled no other grounds in her complaint for divorce for the trial court to consider. Mr. Chung counterclaimed, asking the court to grant him a divorce based upon same constructive abandonment / desertion. I believe cruelty might have been in there, and also based upon a one-year separation upon the expiration of that appropriate period of time. What was interesting enough is that I didn't start the case. I actually came in and took over as substitute counsel for Ms. Sneed. So I became the second counsel for Mr. Chung. And when I took over the case, I saw that Ms. Chung had actually filed, now Ms. Fitzgerald, had filed an answer, or I believe she had filed an answer, which to Mr. Chung's cross-complaint. But during this appellate process, I realized that answer had never actually been filed with the clerk of court. Either way, that answer was never before the court, nor did it actually contain a prayer for relief requesting an award of spousal support. Judge, make a long story short, the facts of the case, then we get to trial, and I made a motion to strike, and the Honorable Judge Sharp granted that motion to strike. And as the court is aware, this matter is on appeal from an amended final order that was entered, which granted my motion to strike, which struck the plaintiff's complaint for divorce. And as the court is aware, the court speaks only through its orders. Despite granting the only pleading before the court, which requested an award of spousal support to the wife, the trial court still awarded spousal support to Ms. Chung. There was no other pleading properly before the court. In fact, the trial court indicated that the trial court acknowledged during its ruling that it researched the issue of law and found no case law to suggest that a court can sua sponte grant a divorce on grounds which were not pled. Acknowledging that being the case, the trial court granted a divorce based upon a one-year separation of Mr. Chung. Your Honors, the issue is, the leading case is, and I'm going to butcher the name, and I apologize, I have a Germanic background.
Rabluski.
I apologize?
Rabluski. Yes, but let's talk about that. Isn't it true that since Rabluski was issued, that the General Assembly's amendment to 20-107.1A specifically state the trial court may make such further decrees as it shall deem expedient concerning the maintenance and support of the spouses, notwithstanding a party's failure to prove his grounds for divorce, provided that a claim for support has been properly pled by the party seeking support?
That's an interesting issue, Judge. Here's the answer that I have to that.
That's why I asked.
Well, the issue is that first,
with answering that question, would you also address that how a pleading that no longer exists is one that's properly pled?
Well, I agree with that. Specifically, there is, even if there is no pleading before the court, how can the issue be properly pled? Is this case, I'm going to ask, I apologize, Judge Olson, I'm going to answer
take his
Mr.
because it's
Mr.
a more friendly question.
Well, it's an easier question for me to answer, and I'm going to get back to that one, Judge. But as this court noted in its ruling in Wolowski, that no court can base its, well, it's actually quoting Harold, no court can base its decree upon facts not alleged, nor render a judgment upon rights, however meritorious, which have not been pled and claimed. Pleadings are as essential as proof, the one not being available without the other, quoting Potts. Judge, this court notes that, or this court noted in Wobolinski, that a written demand for support is necessary as a precondition for an award of support. And once the trial court struck the only pleading that contained the wife's demand for spouse support, the court could no longer proceed to award her any support. And the fundamental rules of pleadings provide that no court can base its judgment or decree upon a right which has not been pleaded or claimed, and that the striking of a pleading has the effect of withdrawing any claims rooted in that particular pleading from consideration. And this is the part that I like the most. A claim that is grounded upon a stricken completing does not linger on in spectral form. So I think that kind of goes really to the heart of the issue, Judge Alley, is that in order for it to be a proper pleading, it just makes logical sense that it has to be contained actually in a pleading. I think that goes to the Boyd case, the Boyd issue, where in that case, both the husband and the wife filed complaints for divorce. The commissioner and chancery actually both survived and got to the commissioner and chancery. And once they got to the commissioner and chancery, the judge decided to award the divorce to the husband but still grant spousal support to the wife. Well, that came up on appeal. The issue was that the wife didn't make any pleadings for spousal support. And I think the court in that case, I'm not sure if it was the Court of Appeals but from the Supreme Court, indicated that had the wife simply made a request in a pleading, any pleading, and then it survived, then spouse support would be fair game. In other words, you don't have to win the divorce to get the relief that you're looking for, as long as it's properly pled. I think the simple answer, Your Honors, is that had the General Assembly just simply said, ask for spouse support in your answer, it would kind of cut through all that red tape. But, Judge, to answer your question, would it be appropriate to retroactively modify a ruling from a trial court that was a case that was fully tried on the merits based upon the case law that existed at the time of the actual trial?
Whether or not it's a substantive right or procedural right?
And I don't believe it's, well, to really answer that question,
you got to ask me a question. I got the answer. So
correct.
So just switch it around a little bit.
So to get to that point, Judge, I think the court has to take into consideration whether or not there was a demonstrated legislative intent for it to be retroactive before you even get to the argument of whether it was substantive or procedural. And pursuant to Title I, I think Section 214, and I have that somewhere here. I apologize. Give me 1 second. It makes it clear that all laws enacted at a regular session of the General Assembly shall take effect on the first day of July following the adjournment of the regular session at which they were enacted unless a subsequent date is specified. So in order for that to apply, Your Honor, the new law that was passed in July of 2018, that became effective July 1 of 2018, there would have been, had to have been language in that particular code section that said it was to be retroactive. If it doesn't say that...
Doesn't the Shiflett case, though, say that if a statute creates a right, that it becomes substantive in nature? And I agree with you. If Lisky was out there and 20-107 had not been amended, I don't see how the other side wins. But I think we have to make a more nuanced determination as to whether or not the amendment to the statute created a substantive right. And Shiflett seems to suggest where something is actually created, that it indeed does become a substantive right.
And, Your Honor, I would agree that it is substantive to go back. I mean, when you have a divorce case... Yes, the parties, each spouse has a duty to support the other during the marriage. But once the divorce case is being enacted or being litigated, and so going forward in the future, does a party have a right to receive spousal support? And that's a factor-based determination by the trial court. And so there is no right to receive spouse support. So yes, if you go back and enact this law, apply it retroactively a year and 2 months after the trial actually occurred, 6 months after the final order was entered, then it would be a substantive modification of Mr. Chung's duties and obligations.
Let me give you an example, and this is one of the more egregious examples, but it's part of our history. Suppose a certain class of people were not entitled to vote because of the color of their skin, and that was enforced by providing some sort of poll tax. In other words, unless you pay this poll tax, you cannot vote. And suppose the Supreme Court of the United States says something to the effect that poll taxes are unconstitutional. And let's assume for the sake of our argument that the person who was subjected to the poll tax had filed suit prior to that change by the Supreme Court or the legislature. Are you suggesting that that does not create a substantive right?
I think that was a very interesting point of time for our country and probably one that we wish to hope forget sooner than later and haven't. I think that's more analogous to the issue in Cohen, though. There was, I think, the Papalee cites a case called Cohen in which the individual was applying for benefits and that the ability to apply for benefits or obtain benefits was procedural and remedial. There's nothing procedural or remedial about the necessity of a party seeking support having to have a valid pleading before the court. So even if I think you get to the point of whether or not, if the court were to accept the argument that a law passed a year later can be retroactively applied absent a demonstration of legislative intent, and then find that it's not substantive, that it's procedural or remedial. Then you get to the analysis of whether or not that new code section doesn't require a valid pleading before the court. And I think pleadings practice still applies. You still have to have something before the court, a requested relief.
And spousal support is simply a creature of statute, isn't it? Didn't change with the amendment.
I would agree, Your Honor. And the case law, I don't think it changes at all. You know, this court notes in Wobolewski, I'm saying it incorrectly, precedent does not support the notion of an extra statutory reservoir of authority for courts to draw from in divorce cases that would enable a court to grant relief based upon a stricken pleading. So, Judge, I think that in order for her to have a proper pleading before the court, even if you get to that point, you get past the substantive and procedural remedial argument, which I don't think is applicable in this case, you still have to ask yourself, does this code section apply to the divorce case? And I don't believe that it does. You still have to have a valid pleading before the court. Again, I think this is the General Assembly's way of kind of correcting the Boyd case. I had the luxury of speaking with Sandra Bowen, who actually argued the Harrell case to the Court of Appeals about this particular issue in the appellant's brief, and that was kind of the thought that we both had, which was Boyd made it kind of a unique situation. It kind of implicitly held that all you had to do was ask for spouse support somewhere. Do it in your answer.
What is the purpose of 20-107, the amendment? What is the purpose of it if it is indeed the way that you view it?
You know, and that's a good question. I don't know, and I'm not familiar with what cases have been coming before the court that really deals with situations in which one party may have claimed, hey, I won the divorce case. I proved my grounds, so they can't get relief. You can only grant relief to the winner of the grounds. And I think that that's the whole point. The point is to be able to say, as long as you request it. Because we've had other cases that have come up, the Ossifon case, the Ruan case, and other cases where somebody just didn't plead it the right way, right or wrong, whether it was an open generic request or whether it was failed to be request. There's case law that came along that said that the general prayer, such other and further relief as the court may deem appropriate, still wasn't good enough because it had to be specified. And proper pleadings practice require that you identify the relief that you're looking for in order for the court to do so. Otherwise, that would violate Potts, which says that the court can only rule and decide based upon the issues that have been properly pled, not go beyond. So I think the whole point of that language is to be able to say, hey, you can get the spousal support as long as you have a proper pleading. And the easy answer is to do it in your answer. And I think that's what the court was, that's what the General Assembly was doing. I don't sit with them, but Judge, I'd like to reserve at least 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
I know we've addressed a lot of rebuttal issues in this part, but
sure.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Carpenter Hughes. I'm here for Ms. Fitzgerald. Can the court hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. As this court is aware, like Mr. Dance, I did not start off in this case. In fact, I've only been involved for the last few weeks. But after reviewing the case file, I don't disagree with opposing counsel's statement of how we got here. I do agree that Ms. Fitzgerald no longer had a valid pleading in front of the trial court after the motion to strike was granted.
So if there's no valid pleading, and that was the only pleading originally that requested spousal support in any form or fashion, whether or not the statutory minimum applies, how do you have anything that is properly pled requesting spousal support before the court that would allow it to issue or determine the issue of spousal support?
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue that the modification of 20-107.1A is specifically geared for a situation such as this.
But if a complaint has been struck, mm-hmm. it's a nullity, correct?
Agreed, yes.
So how is something properly pled if it's a nullity?
Well, that is an interesting argument in that
Well, that's not an argument. That's a
question. I'm sorry.
You can now give me your answer. That takes the form of argument.
Yes. So the specific wording of the modification says that has been pled, not that currently is pled. So I would argue that
if it's a nullity, it hasn't been properly pled because it's been struck. So there's no longer any vehicle before the court from which it can order spousal support. So absent that vehicle, where is the jurisdiction?
Well, again, I would argue that practically speaking, this modification only applies in situations. So I don't think that modification makes it so she can't I understand that the court is asking if the complaint is stricken. My argument is that although the complaint is stricken, it was initially pled, so that this modification, because of the cases that came before it, Rand, Osveden, those cases are different, and the court would still have a vehicle under those cases to award spousal support if here Mr. Chong had mentioned it in his complaint.
Let's take a little hypothetical that I hope will be a very simple one. You file on behalf of a client a complaint alleging personal injury. But at the trial of that case, or at a motions hearing, that complaint is struck. Absent new filing of a complaint or some other vehicle within which to request damages, how then does a judge or jury order damages on a complaint that has been struck?
Well, I think the language of the statute specifically saying has been pled. I understand that her complaint
properly
has been struck
pled.
Now. Properly pled. My argument is that initially her complaint was properly pled, and that although her grounds for divorce were not proved.
But at the risk of going in circles in this and beating a horse till it is far under the ground, what is before the court? What pleading is before the court when it's been struck?
I agree, Your Honor, that she did not have a complaint pleading in front of the court. The opposing counsel
is
correct.
Is there jurisdiction to order anything if there is nothing before the court that requests it?
Your Honor, as you saw in the brief filed by Mr. Williams, and what I'm arguing today is that the modification sort of takes that issue out of it because
how does it take a pleading out of it? How does it take the existence of the very pleading that would request it away from out of the equation?
Just that because initially it was pled properly, and although she didn't meet the grounds for divorce, this modification says if you don't meet the grounds for divorce, if it has been pled, and it had indeed been pled initially. So Mr. Williams' argument in the brief and what I'm here to present today to the court is that language.
So that because of this modification, a court no longer even needs a pleading before it to grant relief?
I would say that because of this modification and the specific wording chosen by the legislator in this modification, that if initially a plaintiff coming in front of the trial court with a proper pleading fails to prove their grounds but had initially filed that pleading properly, then the court still has jurisdiction under that initial pleading because of the language has been pled.
If the complaint's been struck, who is there to determine that it was a proper pleading? Because that hasn't been adjudicated. The complaint's been struck.
There was no demur filed. The only answer was just denying what was in the complaint.
Isn't your argument essentially that 20-107 created a substantive right?
The argument is that 20-107 is a procedural remedial statute such that it can be applied retroactively.
If you view it that way, you're going to lose.
Well, that is the argument put in place in the brief, but, Your Honor, it is spousal support is a substantive right that is created by 20-107, and in the sense that it created a substantive right for Ms. Fitzgerald, I would agree with you. So it's sort of both sides of it.
So your position is that, in your view, make sure I'm clear on this.
Certainly.
Is that 20-107 did not create a substantive right?
Well, it's sort of both. It created a substantive right in that it gave Ms. Chong a vehicle in which to get spousal support, but it's procedural in this sense.
What vehicle did not exist to get spousal support before that? What right did it create? Because there was statutory authority to request spousal support before this. So what did this give that someone didn't otherwise have?
Because the cases that came before it and the ones that were cited in the briefs, Ruan, Osveden, Boyd, Harrell, those pleadings did not contain requests for spousal support. It was maintained in those cases that a general request for other relief wasn't valid, wasn't enough, but that if one party, assuming it's the other side, right, that opened up the issue of spousal support for the court could still grant spousal support to the non-requesting party, the party that didn't have a pleading in front of the court.
It didn't create some new right to spousal support. You were just talking about the way it's to be pled. Is that right?
Right. It did not create spousal support. That spousal support right was already in the statute 20-107.1. It created a substantive right for Ms. Chung in that it gave her the option of, because of those cases, there was a gap in what the court could do, right? If somebody had pled it, the court could grant it. If nobody had, the previous statute said if nobody had pled it, the court couldn't grant it. This statute, the intention is to bridge that gap that was created for people like Ms. Chong. The intent was to correct a manifest injustice for somebody like Ms. Fitzgerald, that came before this court that couldn't prove their grounds to divorce, but that still deserves spousal support.
And didn't plead separation in excess of 12 months as an alternative.
Correct. Her previous counsel did not do that.
What you're suggesting is a way to bail someone out of something that was poorly pled, arguably, to begin with.
Yeah, that was the legislature. That was
so
the legislative.
How is that a substantive right?
Well, to go to Mr. Olson, I think that it's a procedural right in so far as it extended the ability to get to the substantive right of spousal support. But for Ms. Fitzgerald, it created a substantive right because she didn't have the right before because she didn't have a pleading in front of the court. So it gave her the right of spousal support. But it's a procedural in so far as Mr. Chung, because it gave the court a vehicle in which to get there. And so because it's procedural in terms of Mr. Chung, it can be applied retroactively. And if that were the law when this case was decided in January of 2018, then Ms. Fitzgerald could proceed. I think that's the intent of the legislator. That's my argument.
So having sort of recognized that this is a procedural right, your position would then need to be that 20-107 overruled Wroblewski.
Yes, I do argue that, Your Honor. It was... The intention is to do that, is to bridge the gap, to allow for somebody like Ms. Fitzgerald to be able to get spousal support. It was entered after those cases. Wroblewski was entered, you know, well before the statute. And so the intention of the statute is to bridge that gap. And although opposing counsel argues in his brief that the intent language is necessary, it's actually not. In Blinson and Allen, which was cited in Cohen, there, the statutes were somebody was given a limited time period to be able to get the relief, and that time period was extended. And the court found that that was retroactive, that could be retroactively applied because it was procedural and remedial in nature, despite the fact that there was no intent language in the statute. And here we have that same issue, whereas there is no specific intent language in the statute that is, you know, it's not right in there with the language. However, the intention is to allow somebody like Ms. Fitzgerald, who is in this unfortunate predicament where she couldn't prove her grounds for divorce but had previously a proper pleading in front of this court, to be able to be awarded spousal support. So it can be retroactively applied in that sense. And so if this case we're in front of the court today, we're in front of the trial court today, I believe that the modification would allow the judge the authority to grant Ms. Fitzgerald spousal support. And because of that, to go to your question, it can be retroactively applied to this case, although the amended divorce decree was entered earlier this year.
Don't retroactively apply any statute unless it's specifically noted in the statute or is determined to be a substantive right. And you seem to suggest that it is not a substantive right.
Well, Cohen, sorry if I can just look to it. Shifley v. Eller differentiates procedural or remedial statute from substantive ones. It says, while substantive statute grants rights or obligations, a procedural or a remedial statute merely sets forth the methods of obtaining redress or enforcement of rights. That case also quotes Cohen versus Fairfax's Hospital Association and Decker in making this determination. In those cases, it was held that the new statute that does not affect any substantive rights could be applied retroactively. Here, although, Judge Alston, you were saying it was a substantive right for spousal support, and although I agree spousal support is a substantive right, I think this modification is a remedial procedural statute insofar that it just gives a vehicle to getting at that substantive right. That's why it can be applied retroactively. We have a remedial law here.
To get there, we'd have to say that spousal support is a substantive right, and that substantive right has been enhanced or buttressed by 20-107, which seems to suggest that there might not be a need for a pleading.
Yes, that's my argument. Duffy v. Hartsock states that the legislator can pass retroactive and curative laws, provided they don't impair the obligation, contract, or disturb vested rights, and they are such in nature as the legislator might have passed in the first instance to act prospectively. In this case, the legislator obviously could make this prospectively, and it doesn't impede vested rights. The right of spousal support is statutory, but this modification didn't create that right. It created a vehicle in order to get to that right. Counsel argues, that this modification can't be applied retroactively because there's no specific language of intent. That's what I was referencing before. And Blinson and Allen referenced in Cohen, that specific language wasn't required by the court.
To get to somewhat Judge Attlee's point, if indeed the right to spousal support is a substantive right and you believe that there's a procedural mechanism to make this substantive right more proficiently or efficiently applied, why wasn't the statute enabled to also include simple language, this statute shall be applied retroactively?
I just don't think that was required because of the Cohen case. There was nothing in that phraseology that confined that statute. It referenced awards in civil recovery matter. There was nothing required in that phraseology that said it needed to be applied retroactively, but it didn't specify that it wasn't applied retroactively.
But the foundation of our pleading in the Commonwealth of Virginia is notice pleading.
Certainly.
Do you agree with that?
I do.
And if there is no pleading before the court, how do we get the opportunity for the person who is entitled to have notice of what he may be on the hook for, not provided by allowing your argument to go forward, that you don't really have to have a pleading?
Well, I would argue that they certainly were on notice. I mean, this case was filed in 2015 and heard at the end of 2017 and decision made in 2018. So in terms of notice pleading, they certainly were aware of what the requests were in front of the court. So I do believe that they were given notice and the opportunity to.
There was never any finding relating to that pleading because the pleading was struck. And as Judge Ellie pointed out, once a pleading is struck, it's a nullity.
It was struck, but only after Ms. Fitzgerald, previous attorney, had put on the entirety of their case. And so Mr. Chung was certainly on notice of what they were requesting. So with Cohen, it's the same here. The ability to receive spousal support has been extended. And just like in those cases, Winston and Allen and Cohen, that intent language wasn't required. It's not required here. And then in Decker, the trial court had applied a 1991 statute to a 1989 case filing. It was decided in 1993, and that was upheld as appropriate.
Was Ms. Fitzgerald represented by counsel or pro se at the trial level?
She was represented by counsel, Ms. Najat.
Okay.
At all times from the filing until this appeal was noted.
Okay. I was going to ask your opponent colleague this question, but I guess it's undermined by what we're doing. If Ms. Chung was indeed, Ms. Fitzgerald, I'm sorry, was indeed represented by counsel, why didn't counsel at some point, and I would give the benefit of a doubt to a pro se individual, come back to the court and say, Judge, I want to make sure that just because you've struck the pleading, that you're reserving the ability to make the determination on spousal support, which would then make the other side on notice that spousal support was still an issue and thereby be able to present whatever evidence it needed to present to justify its position.
Ms. Najat did file a motion to rehear, as well as she attempted to file an amended pleading under the grounds of separation with all of those spousal support requests in it. So she did, after the decision was made, file two pleadings, bringing it back up to the attention.
The divorce decree had already been granted on the cross-complaint, correct?
It was after the ruling. To be honest, I'm not sure if it was after the decision was made or if it was before the decree was entered. I mean, it was after the trial, certainly. But she did file two pleadings, bringing those issues back up to the trial court, and which were sent to Mr. Chung's counsel. In conclusion, one other thing in the brief, which is that the harmless error is required review in all cases. This is a favored review, and the purpose of the case of this modification was to correct a manifest injustice. So Ms. Fitzgerald will be asking that the lower courts amend the final decree of January 25th, 2018 be affirmed by this court.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Mr. Dance, you've got about 3 minutes.
Thank you, judges.
Sure.
Let me get out of the box with a question because this, to me, is interesting. One could argue that the statute is remedial in nature, and I could see a situation where, suppose one side of the case has vast resources and they're able to litigate a case like this, and the other side is pro se. And obviously people that are pro se do not have the ability to litigate a case as a trained lawyer. And suppose in the context of that case, the individuals proceeding pro se just didn't know how he or she needed to prove their case. And so therefore, because they didn't meet the burden of presenting their case to justify their fault grounds, the pleading is struck. In other words, there may have been something out there, but because of the inability of the pro se individual, they just did not present the evidence. So we end up with a situation where one side of the table has $5 million in assets, the other one has virtually nothing. They've been married for 25 years, so therefore the other person on the other side gets no spousal support. Could that be what the legislature was trying to address?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think it's a bit speculative because I'm not really sure I wasn't a part of the proceedings to make this change. Had I been, I probably would have suggested that they make it more streamlined and clear. Mm-hmm. Judge, I think that, and if I recall correctly, that the Supreme Court has instructed its trial judges to give a great measure of deference to pro se parties. I know as a trial attorney, I see lots of deference where I probably wouldn't like to have it, but it happens.
To the point where it feels like the party with counsel is almost being punished.
I agree 100%. Judge, I don't think, to really answer your question, let's get to the bottom line, is are we doing away with pleadings practice completely? I mean, I think that's what the kind of the issue would be, is that, and I was thinking about this sitting here and I had the benefit of listening, obviously, but what about demur? What if somebody filed a complaint for divorce and then somebody filed the demur? And then somebody wins that demur, and your complaint for divorce was filed, but I demurred, I won, you still filed something. Does that mean you still get to ask for spouse support at the final trial, even though the complaint had been demurred by the trial judge? I believe the answer is no.
Well, is failure to prove grounds the same as a complaint being struck?
I think you can only have a proper pleading before the court if you have a proper ground before the court. Without corroborating evidence, you have no proper complaint. The circuit court only has jurisdiction over a case in a divorce case if there's a valid pleading before the court and if there are one of the five recognized grounds on the 2091.
And there can be multiple things alleged, whether it's pleading in the alternative, constructive desertion, and or separation in excess of 12 months. So your failure to plead prove grounds doesn't mean that your complaint has been struck. Striking a complaint is a completely different remedy than just simply failure to prove particular grounds of divorce. Is that a fair statement?
I don't think that's fair because I think that's also kind of similar to what happened in Harrell, where the complaint actually got all the way to the end and the trial court dismissed it. I mean, what is the operational difference? Wobolski says that if the complaint is struck, well, this motion to strike was granted, so they didn't have the authority to award spouse support to the wife. In Harrell, they didn't strike anything. They just dismissed it for failure to prosecute, so it has the same operational effect. Your Honors, the receipt of spouse support, to answer Judge Alston's question a little bit earlier, receipt of spouse support is not a right. It's a factor-based determination by statute. Because spouse support is not a right, to go back to create a right would be a substantive right, and since it was awarded, then to do so would adversely affect Mr. Chung, and so since it would be a substantive right, it can't be retroactively applied. And I respectfully disagree with counsel. Title 1, 214, specifically states that the General Assembly must otherwise state that it retroactively applies. Judge, in order for the appellee to appeal to win on their argument, this honorable court would first have to find. Well, that's my point. The law that existed at the time of the trial where this matter came before the court, trial court, can be supplanted retroactively by an amendment that occurred almost a year and a quarter later. Then Your Honor would have to find, or the judges would have to find, that the amendment to 20-107.1 contains language that demonstrates it. Also to find that it's not substantive, but then find that it's procedural remedial, then find that a proper pleading is not required, and then find that the harmless error doctrine, which really applies to the receipt of evidence, not necessarily procedural change, still applies, and I just don't think you get there. Your Honor, I respectfully request this matter to be remanded, that the trial court's decision regarding the issue of spouse support be reversed and vacated for that issue, and that Mr. Trumbull awards attorney's fees as a result of this appeal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, judges.
We will come down and greet counsel, and then what we're going to do is take a brief recess, and when we return, we will start with the Spratley matter. And I'll just once again ask counsel, if you haven't signed in, if you'd sign in while we're on the break. Thank you.